Welcome to the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine's Research Learning Series podcast, which focuses on helping you become a STAR research scholar. And I'm Michelle Lin from Academic Life in Emergency Medicine and UC San Francisco, your host for today. Today's episode is on the topic of how to draft a manuscript, featuring one of my research idols, Dr. Craig Newgard. He's a professor of emergency medicine and director for the Center for Policy and Research in EM at Oregon Health and Sciences University. And plus, he's just a cool guy to hang out with. You know, this topic of writing a manuscript is not really something that residents and faculty are taught. And if you were anything like me, you just joined a research team, potentially with a study already in progress, you helped some data collecting, you are in charge of maybe writing a little bit of the results section of the manuscript, and voila, magically, you see the manuscript fully formed and assembled in front of you over several days, weeks to months. And through repetition, you eventually pick up on the nuances on how to write a manuscript. But wait, there's got to be a better way, right? Can we not learn the basics to manuscript writing in a more prospective and structured fashion? And indeed, that's what Craig is here to share with us. And it's a general recipe-like approach to the manuscript framework that can serve as a sound foundational starting point for any manuscript that you launch, whether it be in education, health policy, or clinical research. So before Craig shares his golden approach to manuscript writing, you'll hear that he references his slides, and it's because this podcast was adapted from a video webinar. Now, you don't really need to see them, but you can access them at their SAEM Research Learning Series webpage. Okay, Craig, take it away.
Thank you, everyone, for joining. I'll say from the start that I like this topic a lot because the goal is to give you the tools to try to generate a product. And in addition to that, the sort of concept and nuts and bolts of writing research manuscripts is a challenge across all levels. That is going from students up through senior faculty. And what I found is that as more time goes on and people get higher up in the academic ladder, that they are less likely to ask for help in this regard because they feel like this is a skill set they should already know, they should already own. So hopefully this is useful for you. And what we're going to cover, I'm going to spend the first several slides going through some preparation steps for writing. One critical component of that is time management. And then I will go through the nuts and bolts of writing a manuscript, including each section of the template.
Now, to the listeners out there, Craig references a PDF template that provides a recipe-like framework for writing manuscripts from start to finish, from A to Z. Now, this link is going to be in the podcast show notes, so take a look there. It's also on the SAM website. It's definitely, definitely well worth the download and sharing with your academic colleagues. Trust me, it'll save you a lot of heartache in the short and long term. Plus, sharing is caring.
We're also going to go through how to interpret a journal's decision letter, the revising and resubmitting process, and finally, some post-acceptance guidance.
Now, Craig, before you launch into sharing your secret sauce for manuscript writing, can you share some more big picture thoughts about research? I mean, why publish in journals at all?
For one, this is the main mechanism for moving the scientific needle. Regardless of what field you are doing your research in, the only way to truly move that scientific needle or push the science is to publish. Publishing is the accepted mechanism for vetting research and communicating our findings. So you can't just post all your results on a blog and expect that people are going to consider this the truth and use it. It has to go through the peer review and publication process. We also have an ethical obligation to our patients. Even for a retrospective project, there is some risk to patients, even if just confidentiality. So we are obligated to them to actually see these projects through and to publish our results. It's an integral aspect of promotion and academic advancement. And on a very practical level, why would you spend all this time completing a research project and not publish it?
Well said. But there are so many journals out there, and we've spent our blood, sweat, and tears completing a study and writing the manuscript. Any advice on deciding to which journal to submit our prized possession?
I'd say, for one, to be realistic, but not afraid to try a reach journal. And the strategy that I like to use, and one that I promote with our faculty, our fellows, and residents, is to pick three journals, your first, second, and third option, so that you have a clear pathway. If it gets rejected by the first, journal A, you got a plan for journal B. Look at impact factor and their readership. Generally, as impact factor goes up, the readership is going to be broader. It's going to be harder to get in, but maybe more likely to be cited. And I would look at who is the target audience. Who do you want to get your message out to? If you are doing a study and publishing on, say, national guidelines related to trauma care, you would ideally like to get into a journal that has a close affiliation with the national body that creates those guidelines. So, for example, maybe you're going to target the Journal of the American College of Surgeons. So I would think about that when selecting a journal, and also plan to publish in journals both within and outside of your field, because it's going to expand your reach.
Now, you mentioned time management earlier. We're all so busy and juggling a million things. Got any pearls of wisdom on this with respect to manuscript writing?
This seems obvious, but it is an absolutely crucial part of writing. Writing takes time. This is not something that goes quickly. My suggestion would be to block a minimum of 2 hours every week, ideally maybe four. And I think that the best way to do this would have it be the same time block on the same day every single week. Okay. My time block is Thursday morning. That's when I write. So then I know I have time every week that I am not scheduled for shifts, and dedicated time that I can write. Find a place where you can write uninterrupted. Maybe this is your office. The office is not really a place that I can write. Maybe it's home. Maybe it's a cafe. Figure out where that is and use it. Turn off your email. Okay. We are not as good at multitasking as we think we are. It's actually more task shifting. So every time you get an email popped up, it turns your attention away from your manuscript. Just turn that off. Silence your cell phone. And do not let more than 1 week go by without touching your manuscript. Touching meaning you are opening the file, you are revising, you are adding, you are working on tables, you are keeping it in your brain space.
Great. Those are fantastic time management tips. But let's say that I sit down, like you said, at a cafe every Thursday morning. Now what? I know personally I am not a natural writer. Much better editor, not a natural writer. What advice do you have for those of us who don't see ourselves as writers?
I would encourage you to consider yourself as a writer. Embrace the concept of you as a writer. Also embrace the technical skills and the language involved with writing. Okay, this should not be a one-off or one manuscript wonder sort of project. This is going to be something that you integrate into your job and that you use for the rest of your career. Another technique in this regard is seeking out and studying examples of really solid scientific writing. So how would you do this? My suggestion would be to look at some of the very high impact general medical journals, such as the New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, Lancet. There are several others out there. And not only to read these articles for the content and the science, but read them with regard to how they structure their argument. How do they frame their argument? How do they use wording? How do they organize their paragraphs? What does the methods section look like? And you're going to take all those pearls and integrate them into your own paper. And finally, just like any skill, this is a practiced, learned skill. Some people might be inherently better than others, but all of us can write. Just like maybe if you want to learn how to play electric guitar, you want to learn a new language, you want to become a figure skater, whatever the case may be, this is going to take practice and dedicated time. It is no different. Write, write, write.
Okay, everyone. So repeat after me. I am a writer. I am a writer. Thanks, Greg. Next topic, authorship. Any thoughts on this?
I would suggest being inclusive with authorship and to try to pull people into your writing team that are not only going to help your product and add to the content to your paper, but are going to help you to learn how to write and help you to finish that project, that writing aspect of the project. So these may be mentors, they might be experts in the field, they might be people that have just really unique perspectives. So, for example, we did a study looking at the media coverage for exception from informed consent trials. And we invited one of the media relations people at our university to be on the author team, which normally would not have been someone we would have integrated as a co-author. But she had incredible insight that the rest of us really didn't have. So she was an excellent person that we learned from as a co-author in that paper. Building a team, and also kind of similar to what you should be doing at the start of a project, talk about the roles and the place of authorship at the start of the project. It will save you some headaches at the end. Okay, so now we're going to launch into the nuts and bolts of writing a manuscript. And as I mentioned before, there is a PDF document that I have put together that is a recipe for writing. Similar to maybe baking a cake or any other recipe, you would not be expected to just remember all the ingredients off the top of your head. Writing is no different, okay? There is a recipe. I'm giving you one. Please use it. It will catalyze the effort. I'd also suggest to read and follow the journal author guidelines. So for those journals A, B, and C, whichever journal it is that's journal A, take a look at their author guidelines. Those are specific to that journal and may help frame or organize how you format your paper as you're starting to write. A well-written manuscript is much more likely to be accepted, everything else being kept the same. So it is money in the bank to spend time crafting your message and your argument. You should be able to ask yourself and answer, what is the key message and why does it matter? Okay, that should come through in the paper. Your readers, it should be obvious to them in your paper kind of what the answers to those questions are. I would block time every week, as I mentioned, and do not stop until it is submitted. Okay, this is something that you do not want to put down. You do not want to wait 6 or 12 months, because every time you stop, you go in reverse. And it takes more time to ramp back up to get to that point where you can continue crafting that manuscript.
Great. So let's dive into it. Let's talk about the nuts and bolts of each section of the manuscript. Let's take it from the top.
Starting with the title of the manuscript, the title is very important. This is probably the most commonly seen piece of information about this piece of work, about this manuscript. So if you think about, as you're going through, say, a lit search in PubMed, typically it's titles that are going to be the first thing that are going to come up. So make sure that your title is clear, succinct, has some catchiness to it. It should not be boring. This should capture really the essence of the paper, which should make people want to read it. Author order, a little bit of detail about the author order. Many of you probably understand this, but it can take time to really fully appreciate the nuances. So the lead author or the first author should really be the person who's doing the lion's share of the work. They came up with the idea, they conducted the project, they invested the most time, they wrote the paper. The next most highly regarded position is the senior author or the last author on the paper. And often this is not just the senior most member of the writing group, but the person who's really conducted a large amount of work behind the scenes. Maybe they helped secure funding. Maybe they were a key mentor. Maybe they're the content expert. Maybe they helped to organize logistics and operations to allow this study to happen. Another key position is second author, which is often reserved for the biostatistician or maybe a author who has done a large amount of work but doesn't quite fit the senior author role, okay? So the author order is very important. Everybody else sort of falls in the middle, is not quite as important as those three positions. Word count, so generally a journal is gonna tell you exactly what your maximum word count is. I usually target 3,000 to 3,500 words, which is commonly or relatively close to the range of most journals. The funding and the acknowledgement sections I have in that template with a little bit of self-explanatory information and some examples. Beyond the title, the abstract is probably the next most widely read piece of information about your manuscript. So you want to make sure that your abstract captures key information and really highlights the purpose of the paper and the key conclusions and findings. Most of the time, the word count is somewhere in the 250 to 350 range. and generally has four sections: the study objective, the methods, the results, and finally, conclusions. Jumping into the manuscript itself, the introduction part is a very important part of the manuscript. I think Annals of Emergency Medicine has a nice kind of template or format for how to organize thoughts. I use these general concepts in most manuscripts that I write. The intro generally consists of three paragraphs. The first is talking about the general background of a topic, why it is important, maybe public health relevance. If you're talking about injury, for example, you might start with something about how injury is the most common cause of death of people aged 1 to 44 years of age. Some framing of the topic. Paragraph 2 is much more specific for setting the stage for why you asked the study question and why it is important. It's going to highlight gaps in the literature, what the particularly unique aspects of this study question is and why this needs to be answered. And it should be obvious to the reader of moving from the second paragraph, the importance, into the third paragraph, where you explain the goals of the study or the study objective, that, oh, this was an obvious study to be done based on what I just read. Okay. The length of the intro is typically 1.5 double-spaced pages. The entire manuscript should be double-spaced, and about 1.5 pages is the right target for how long it should be. And in general, the intro sets the stage for why the study was done. You should be able to frame your argument and the importance of this scientific question in the intro. If you can't do that and people are wondering why the study was done, this doesn't seem very important, then you haven't done a very good job with the intro. So make sure that you spend time kind of framing that in the intro. The methods. The methods section is a meaty section of the manuscript, and my very strong suggestion is to use subheaders. I've included subheaders in that template, and subheaders are useful for a variety of reasons. For one, is that it's going to give you a guide for how to explain the methods. It's going to break down these very sort of complicated pieces of the methods section and organize it for you in the writing. It's also going to organize it for the reader and taking them through the internal logistics of the study and the different aspects about how the study was done. So if we go through these one by one, I'll kind of briefly explain each of them. So the study design section is what I typically start a method section with. And this might only be a couple sentences. Generally starts with what the actual study design was. This was a retrospective cohort study of, you know, whoever was included. This was a randomized controlled trial. This was a cluster randomized trial. Whatever the study design is, and then I also include the IRB language. The Oregon Health and Science University IRB reviewed and approved this study and waived the requirement for informed consent. Okay, that's all packaged under study design. Study setting is an opportunity for you to explain where this study was done and for the reader to get a feel for how this study would, or how these patients were accessed. If it's a single hospital, you should be able to put down what type of hospital. Was it an academic or community center? How many beds? What is their volume? What are the services provided? If it's a study done in the out-of-hospital setting, you're going to want to say how many EMS agencies, what is the type of 911 system. If it's a multi-site or multi-region study, maybe you're talking about the systems of care. So that generally has a good sense of what the setting was in which the study took place. The next header is the patient population. This is going to be where you're going to put the inclusion and exclusion criteria. And sometimes there's reasons that you need to justify why certain criteria were used. A reader should be able to look at the study population section and be able to tell whether the group of patients sampled for this project is similar or different from the ones that they're looking to apply the results to. If it was an interventional trial, I would have a subheader on the intervention. What was it? If it was a randomized controlled trial, you're going to talk about what that intervention was, how it was delivered, maybe any citations that back up the use or timing of that intervention. Next in line is a subheader on variables, and every variable that you present in the results should be in the variables section. Sometimes these are going to need some justification as well for how they were defined or accessed and where the data came from. The outcomes is very important. Typically, this is going to start off with the primary outcome, and I'd also recommend putting in any citations that you can about why that primary outcome was used and how it was defined in this project. You might need to explain in text how you or some version of a justification for use of this outcome, and also the secondary outcomes you were looked at, how those were derived, how they were captured, how are they defined, and those time points. Okay, that all falls under the outcome subheader. The sample size or power, this might be lumped under the statistical analysis section, might be its own section. It's not going to be in every paper, but if you did one, make sure to include it. And finally, the statistical analysis section is going to be where you're going to explain how the data were analyzed. If you had models included, how those models were built, how you selected variables for the model, how the model was refined, the metrics for how well that model functioned, the accuracy of the model, the performance of the model, and the software that you used to conduct the statistical analysis. In general, the method section tells you how to replicate the study or tells a reader how to do it, and it also talks in detail about the rigor of the study. It's a very critical aspect of a manuscript. This can often be written well before a given study is done.
To the listeners, note that Craig spent a lot of time focusing on the methods section. It's a robust section. I've even heard that manuscript reviewers sometimes actually start with the methods section first, since if a study is poorly conducted or poorly explained, no amount of window dressing will remedy that. It's a quick and easy decision to just check the reject box. So indeed, definitely spend time focusing on crafting your methods section clearly, thoughtfully, and deliberately. Okay, sorry to interject there, Craig. Let's continue with the next section, results.
As a general rule, it is your opportunity to sensibly guide the reader through the results, okay? The first paragraph most commonly lists the primary sample and how you got there. If there were excluded patients, you're going to want to list those numbers, maybe give a brief explanation of why they were excluded, how you arrived at your final sample, and some characteristics of the final sample, including reference to the quote-unquote table one, which we will cover, which is in most papers and is a characterization of the sample so that readers have a really good feel about who do these patients represent, how sick or not sick were they, how similar or dissimilar are they to the ones my own patient population or the patients that I would like to try to apply these results to. Paragraph two, and this is where there's more variability as you read more manuscripts. My suggestion for paragraph two is to cut right to the main results. Don't make the reader wait, okay? This is why they are reading your paper. Give them what they want and give them something that you want them to really remember. Don't bury the main results in the fourth or fifth paragraph. You can use paragraphs three, four, or five to talk about stratified analyses, subgroup analyses, the additional results, maybe the sensitivity analyses, but those would come after the main results. Okay, and moving into the rest of the sections, discussion, limitations, and the study conclusion. So the discussion section, again, there's a lot of variability for how these can be written. I'll give you some general pearls that I think hold true for most sections. The first paragraph most commonly is a summary of the key findings and a couple sentences that are going to set the stage for what you're going to cover in the rest of that section. It should not be a literature review, okay? Where the results section is very objective and factual, the discussion is your opportunity to explain and dissect and deconstruct the results. Why are they important? Put them in context of existing literature. What are key citations? How are they similar or different from other studies? Why do they matter? What are the clinical implications? What are the policy implications? Okay, this is your chance to really talk about those results and try to pick them apart and why they're meaningful. The limitations is going to come next, and this is your opportunity to provide transparency in what the limitations are of the project. Every single project has limitations, so put them there. It's also your opportunity to beat the reviewers to the punch, okay? So if you understand what the limitations are, you can frame them in a little bit more positive light, or at least an objective light, make sure that you put them down. Typically, this is 2 to 3 paragraphs. At the same time, I would keep in mind to not go crazy on the limitation section. If your limitation section is longer than your discussion section, a reader might look at it and say, wow, they just kind of crushed this paper. Maybe the study wasn't very good. Maybe I should not use this. Okay, so you want to have balance there. And finally, the conclusion section might be a standalone section. It might be the very last paragraph of a discussion. The most common mistake made in that section is that the conclusions are not supported by the results of the project. Make sure that your conclusions are directly supported by your results and that they do not overstate the results. Sometimes there's an opportunity to include potential clinical or policy implications there as well. So references, it took me many years to understand this, but I would strongly recommend using a reference manager. EndNote is one that's been around for a long time, but there are many others. Some are free. This will make your life easier, and ultimately all of us are looking for ways to make our life easier. So use a reference manager. Typically the references are cited in order as they come up in the manuscript, and every journal has slightly different preferences for formatting. One of the beauties of using a reference manager is that you can select what that format is and will automatically reformat all of your references. And also, as you're revising your manuscript, if you cut and paste a big section from one spot to another spot in the manuscript, the reference manager will be able to keep pace and reshuffle all those references for you. Tables and figures. This is a crucial part of the manuscript. Most journals, I'd say, have a max somewhere around 4 to 5, but it's going to vary depending on the individual journal. The table one, which we talked about briefly earlier, is a common table that's in most manuscripts. I have an example up here. This is the characterization of the sample for your readers. So you can understand some of the demographics, some of the clinical information, comorbidity information, etc. I think one of the key parts of this is to put this sample in context so that a reader might be able to compare to their own patient population or other literature for how similar or not it is. Figures. Figures can be highly effective, and please use them. As a general rule, illustrative information in figures can portray things that cannot or are very difficult to get to come through in table or text format. You can visually show relationships between variables that can be very difficult to come across through text or through numeric values in tables. David Schreiger, one of the editors of Annals of Emergency Medicine, has published several excellent articles on tips and do's and don'ts for creating effective figures. That's a nice place to go if you want more detailed information about creating figures. I'd say as a general rule, you want to maximize the information in a given figure without confusing people. And one other thing that I will mention going back to those sections is that I would not burden yourself with exactly how a given sentence sounds or the phrasing of it is. You're just trying to create a first draft, okay? I feel like it's easier to use sort of a free writing strategy where you're just simply getting your thoughts down into the document. It might be an outline format. Maybe you have a bunch of ideas for the intro and framing the argument. Don't worry about creating sentences. Don't worry about how it sounds. Just get that information into each of those sections and under each of the subheaders, and then you're going to go back through and revise and craft and wordsmith that message. Every time you revise a manuscript, my suggestion would be to save it as a new dated file, whatever the file name is, and then with that day's date. It only takes one time if you're working off the exact same file to experience the utter visceral pain of that file getting corrupted and losing the entire thing to learn that lesson. So my suggestion would be to don't run that exercise. I've already done it. The way to get around that is to save it as a new file every single time. Some people will put version 12, 13, 14, et cetera. My problem with that is if you're saving on different computers, your laptop, you may not really remember which version you're on. This is a way of knowing exactly when that work was produced. And you are going to revise over and over and over. It's a very iterative process. Your goal with a draft manuscript is to get it to where the piece becomes stable, to when you're reading through it and you're not really changing that much anymore. That's when it's time to send out to your co-authors. You don't want to send a half-baked piece to your co-authors. You want to use their time wisely. And also, you know, my take on this, my strategy on this is to only give the co-authors one shot to revise it. Again, it's part of respecting their time. They don't have time to read and reread multiple versions of your manuscript. Your mentor may be willing to do that, but otherwise, try to respect the time of your co-authors. So you want to send them a stable, polished piece. This should be the best piece that you can create, and that now it's time to get the input of others. And an industry standard, what I would say, is a deadline of 2 weeks. Give them a date and ask for those comments to come back to you within a two-week period. If you're working with a big author group, inevitably there'll be some people who don't get it back to you within 2 weeks, and it's time to send them a tactful email reminding them about the importance of their insight, their comments, and the need to hear back from them in order to justify keeping them as a co-author on the work. And finally, you're going to get it submitted, okay? Don't put it down until it's done.
Wow, Craig, that was a terrific deep dive into the nuances of manuscript writing section by section, piece by piece. Unfortunately, as we all know, the process doesn't end there with submitting your final draft to the journal. Now, sure, you can kick back for a few weeks while you await their peer review, but now walk us through what happens. What's the post-submission experience like?
You will get a letter back, generally with one of three messages. The first is accept without revisions, which is almost never the case. The second one is revise and resubmit. This is what you're shooting for. This means the journal is interested in your work. You have a foot in the door. And the last one is rejection, which is common and universal. A couple points that I want to mention about this is, and this title at the top is what I'm seeing most commonly, we regret to inform you that. Don't be discouraged by this. Every single person, every single scientist, every person submitting manuscripts, every one of them has gotten rejected. It is universal. And if you are one of the few who has not been rejected yet, maybe you're playing it too safe. Maybe you need to send it to some higher impact journals. Okay, if it's seeming too easy, too smooth to get into certain journals, maybe your work is better than what you think it is, and you should shoot for a higher bar. After you get this letter back, which often will include reviewer comments, I would wait a week and then reread it. Pull out the useful ones, pull out the pearls, integrate them into a revised version of your manuscript, and then move on to Journal B. You already have that Journal B lined up from your journals A, B, and C that you figured out when you were first starting to write. And your manuscript will get better over time. Don't take it personally. Pull out the good stuff, use it, and move on. Do not give up. And at this point, too, this is a common point where people might put this away for 6 months or 12 months or 2 years or maybe forever, and it dies. Don't let it stop there, because every time you stop at this point, you're going to go in reverse. And to catch back up to that mind space where you can remember all the literature search, the arguments, the framing, how to put all this stuff together, that's when the time is right to pull it all together, make those adjustments, make those revisions, and move on to the next journal.
Okay, so let's say that your manuscript wasn't rejected and you got the encouraging revise and resubmit response. After high-fiving all of your co-authors, what's next?
Revising and resubmitting, there is an art to doing this. First, I would look and see what the deadline is. Most letters will have a specific deadline. The soonest I've seen is 2 weeks. Most commonly, I think it's 4 weeks. My own strategy and what I have up on the screen here is a response to reviewer comments letter that I wrote for an article submitted that I submitted to Academic Emergency Medicine. I have kind of a format for this, which is what I'm going to take you through. My own strategy is to have a block at the top where you're going to thank the editor and those reviewers for their comments. I also outline how to find in the revised manuscript where those changes are. The strategy I typically use is that I will highlight them in yellow, sort of the background color yellow, unless the journal has some other mechanism they would like for highlighting where those changes are made. As a general rule, if you can make it easier on the editor, it is more likely to be accepted. If you're going to make the editor's job hard, then you're reducing your probability of acceptance. Okay, so for all of those comments, I first will copy the block of them into a new document, and I will split them up and boldface and put them in quotes so that the editor knows exactly where they came from. And under each one of those blocks of comments, those boldface quoted comments, I will answer them. So it's a very methodical way of being able to address every single comment that each of the reviewers had. You should address each of them separately. If many of them say the same thing, you can lump them all together under kind of one little area and address them together. But make sure to be very thorough in addressing each of the comments. And also, tone, compromise, and reanalyses are very important. Okay, this is not the time to be defensive or use any sort of condescending tone. You want a very gracious, humble tone. You want to reach compromise no matter what the comment was. You want to take the high road on responding to it. And oftentimes they will ask for a reanalysis of the data. Some of these may not be possible based on what you have, but as a general rule, I try to do the reanalysis. You try to bend over backwards to address each of the comments, do the reanalysis, repackage that manuscript in a way that the reviewers and editor are looking for, and this will increase your odds of them actually accepting it. Finally, this is your last chance to revise the paper. So take one last good look at it. Any changes should be done at that point. And finally, you will get articles accepted. Okay? Yes, this is a time to celebrate. This has been what you've been working so hard for. A couple things to take care of on this final stretch is filling out remaining conflict of interest or copyright forms. These can slow down the publication of your manuscript. If you don't get them done, you want to look for page proofs, which are no longer coming from the editor. These are now coming from the publisher, and this is formatted to the journal kind of guidelines and page layout. This is your opportunity to look over exactly how your article is going to look in print or in the online version of the journal, as the case may be. This is not the time to make major changes. These are small grammatical wording changes and double-checking tables and figures. I would also suggest contacting your hospital's media relations department. Not every article is going to be newsworthy, but many of them are. And they will help you craft the message, get it out to the media, and ultimately the media serves as a huge machine to get your message out there, okay? Both through more traditional mechanisms such as print or newspapers or TV news coverage, but also through a huge online media presence. They will help get your message out in ways that you are not able to otherwise. The embargo date is really important. The embargo date is basically the date when your manuscript is published. Okay, nothing can be put out before the embargo date. If you put out a media release and get coverage before the embargo date, you might be jeopardizing your article being published. They might pull it because you've one-upped the journal on that message and those findings. So make sure that you respect the embargo date. The media knows very well what the embargo date represents. And finally, use social media. Especially Twitter is a very common vehicle nowadays for getting the message out there. Use that as a way for promoting your work and getting the word out there. And I have a small little figure here for the Altmetrics score, which is increasingly being picked up and tracked by journals as a way of not only tracking traditional media coverage, but also online media coverage for your paper. How to work with the media. Again, the embargo date we just talked about, When you write a press release, you want to write it for easy consumption. You want to craft your message so it's very easily understood, especially for the lay audience. And if there are interview requests coming through, this might differ a little bit hospital to hospital, but at least in my university, our media relations department vets these interview requests. Not all of the interview requests are legitimate. Not all of them have your best interests in mind. So in general, all the media requests go through the media relations, and then they are sent to you. Be consistent with your messaging as you're talking with different reporters or writing different pieces. Make sure that they all are consistent with your study. And the other point I'll make is that these people have very, very short, tight timelines, okay? They are either typically within like 24 hours. So take advantage of them because they will help get your message out there in ways that you would not otherwise be able to, but you need to be really timely in responding to them and doing the interviews.
Those are excellent insights. Let's start wrapping up things now. What are your key takeaway points?
There are many benefits to writing and publishing research manuscripts. Okay, we covered that. I would strongly recommend crafting your job and your schedule to include consistent writing time. Ideally, this is the same day and the same time block every single week. Okay, set up your schedule so that if Tuesday afternoons are a day that you are not working clinically or where you have open time, use that time every single week so you can count on it for writing and so that you never put your manuscript down until it's submitted. Embrace the concept of you as a writer. Again, this is not just a one-off or a one manuscript wonder sort of thing. This is something you are integrating into your workflow, you're integrating into your career path, and it's one other piece that you're going to put under your job that you place value on and that you develop skills in. Use the template. Please use the template that I sent to you. I've sent it to our faculty, to our fellows, our residents. It lays out the recipe, will help you organize your thoughts and take you through writing a manuscript. So it's not just sitting there looking at a blank screen trying to figure out what you're going to write. And be diligent and submit your work. And of course, write, write, write.
Indeed, write, write, write. Speaking of writing, there were a few questions that were written in for you. Ooh, here's a good one. What if you disagree with a few of your reviewers' comments on a revise and resubmit response on your manuscript? Does disagreeing with them decrease your chances of getting your manuscript accepted?
In general, it's fine to disagree with some of the comments or some of the suggestions. I would keep in mind that if you disagree with too many and you're kind of becoming high maintenance or difficult to work with, that editor can simply say no and just decline your manuscript. So there is some balance there. If you don't want to do some of the suggestions or maybe you're just not able to, I will try to spend some extra time explaining why and maybe using some citations to kind of justify your argument. And keep in mind that if you're saying no too many times, you might be jeopardizing that paper, okay? So I think that there is some balance there. It's okay to say no, but to try to use some tact, use a gracious tone, and really justify your argument of why you cannot do or really don't want to do one of the specific suggestions.
Great answer, Craig. It's definitely a fine balance to strike. Okay, let's see what else we have here in the question bag. Ooh, here's one on authorship order. Let's say you have more than three authors and you set the authorship order early on as suggested. However, your fifth author really stepped up her game and has contributed a lot of work and time into the manuscript. Now what? Should you consider moving authorship order around late in the game to be more fair? What's your strategy for this?
Authorship can be really tricky. Often there's maybe multiple authors who've really done a huge amount of work, but their author position doesn't feel like you're giving back to them as much as you should. So I think there's a couple of different ways to handle that. If you talked about author order at the start of the project and things played out differently, maybe somebody who was going to be senior author really didn't contribute that much. Sometimes that happens. I think it's okay to have a conversation with them and to readjust the author order. That is all before the manuscript is submitted. Okay, once you've submitted a manuscript, it's pretty concrete. Often journals are going to ask for a very specific explanation why you adjusted author order after the manuscript was submitted. So all that should be worked out prior to the submission. And then the other point is that most projects will have multiple papers that could be written from them. So, you know, authorship is kind of a form of academic currency. So maybe with a given project, there's a primary paper, but maybe there are three or four other papers that are going to come out of it. So that gives you other opportunities to kind of academically pay back people that have done a really important job for you. Or maybe one of those papers as a secondary analysis, they could be the lead author on. So I think this is a way of being very inclusive and collegial and collaborative, and thinking up some other ideas that you use that data for will open up opportunities for navigating it.
I love that approach of splitting the data set and study into multiple publications with rotating authorship positions. Okay, so here's a final question for you, Craig. And it's a common problem that I often see novice manuscript writers do. And that is having a lot of duplicate material between the introduction and discussion sections. What's your approach in deciding what goes into each section?
I would step back and look at the intro and make sure that you're not using it as a literature review. I see many manuscripts where people put too much stuff into the intro. Okay, the intro should be pretty focused, you know, the first paragraph, kind of a general overview. The second paragraph should really be framing your argument and why this study was done. Anything beyond that should probably go into the discussion section. A lot of the citations and covering previous literature and counter findings or whatever the case may be, oftentimes those things are better moved into the discussion section rather than the intro. So the intro can stay very succinct and clear and short and to the point to frame your study, and then to really dissect everything in the context of the existing literature, use the discussion section for that part of it.
Well, that's a wrap. Thanks so much to Dr. Craig Newgard for sharing his experience on manuscript writing and tips on maximizing your success for publication. Now remember, get into the mindset that you are a writer, follow the manuscript template that Craig meticulously outlined, and remain humble when addressing peer review and editorial comments. But most importantly, don't give up. What you're doing matters and is important to move the scientific needle. So that's a wrap for today. Thank you for listening to the SAEM Research Learning Series. Subscribe to our Academic Life and Emergency Medicine podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes to catch our next episode. See you next time.